guess she can get a sense whether or not sometimes the questions aren't heard.
Yeah, I know. We'll stop. I can still, yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah, it's good to practice. So I wanted to talk just about a couple things, sort of with an eye to the sit next week, partly. You know, it won't sound too practical, probably, but I hope it has some practical uptake, you know, and that, you know, it's some use to somebody. And then also, it kind of grows out of the stuff on mindfulness and concentration that we were listening to Jones talks about, and that she talked about at our retreat in late February and early March. And so I wanted to start with one thing about mindfulness, you know, and I want to take off from something that Joan mentioned in one of the talks, which was really rich to a few of us, I think, which was the notion that mindfulness, as she's talking about it, once it's coupled with concentration practice and put back in a sort of full range of practices kind of context, one of the things it can mean very much is mindfulness of memory. So that you're not always, you know, especially if you're just sitting on the cushion, mindful of what's going on, but you may find that a kind of sense memory of a place or an impression, and it may be recent or it may be very far away, starts really sort of washing over you. And the idea would be maybe that if that seems like a good thing to you to do, just sit with that for a while, and you don't really need to do much else with it, you know. I think... Jen's husband Ken and I seem to be especially susceptible to this. We're sort of downloading movies in our heads of, you know, someplace in upstate New York or someplace that we were a long time ago. But so it could be recent or it can be long ago. I wanted to talk about it just because I had something happen a couple days ago when I was sitting that was a fairly strong version of it for me. And what happened is I was up in Flagstaff for some pentathlon thing with my fifth grade son. It was a sort of staying in tent and all that. It was really nice, but on the way back, people wanted to tour a couple of things. So we went to Sunset Crater, which I'd never seen before. I don't know if any of you have seen that. It's a sort of a volcano, a bunch of volcanic ash, lots and lots of mountains of it, and then trees and other stuff that started to grow back out of it. And then we went also to, I guess it's Wipatki, which is about 1,000-year-old Indian ruin. So there's a kind of pueblo, and then a couple of ball courts and very sort of old rock formation, you know, some stuff built out of stone, sitting in this kind of basin. And a lot of the trip was really windy, and for Flagstaff, it was really, really hot, you know, especially sort of walking around. So one of the things that meant is while I was there, my sense of being in the landscape was really quite visceral and, you know, kinetic and physical. And I found when I started sitting, when I got back, I hadn't sat for a couple of days, and I was going to do something else. And just that sense of sort of downloading the landscape sort of washed over me. So I thought I would sit with that, and I sat with it really for, you know, my sits for every day until I got here. So two or three days, you know. One of the things, I think, partly because it was so hot, you know, but I want to stress that at least for me, one of the things that'll happen is really sort of visceral and bodily, and it wasn't quite rhythmic, but I think I mentioned these a couple times. For a kind of rhythmic thing that may be similar for some of you, if you've been on a boat all day long and then you go to sleep and you lie down, you can really feel the boat, you know, your body in the boat and your boat in the body, and that sense of being sort of permeated by that place, and the place is still in you, and the sense memory of the place is sort of intertwined with all kinds of other things in you. It can be that. Similar things might happen if you go to a multi-day retreat. You might feel really, as you lie down to sleep, that you're still sitting. And, you know, whatever dancing would be like that if you've had a sort of powerful experience of dance. But so I had really that sense of just almost sort of being the landscape or being in the landscape. And then another thing that happened, and I don't know if this is peculiar or not, whether other people experience it, but I had a very strong sense when I was in the landscape, and then it came back to me when I was sitting with it, of, it's hard to talk about it, but sort of various tempi, you know, various sort of tempos of movement. You know, if you're in a sort of volcanic landscape, there's that sense of something really old, you know, that hasn't changed very much in you know, hundreds of years, this very sort of incredibly gradual process of transformation, and just a lot of staying just the way it is, you know. And then the trees are growing at a slightly different pace. There's some really pretty flowers that, you know, have a different sort of time signature, and then birds are sort of flying through and people are walking through. There's a sense of lots and lots of sort of different time schemes and movements. And I found when I started sitting with it that really came back to me. One of the things I like about that is you can have a sense of clock time really falling away. And so clock time, I guess, for us is this mathematical time that every other time gets measured against in some very precise way. If that feels less important, then in a way things are sort of moving against other things. You know, so there's like the time of the mountain, and you could think about sort of the time of the tree in relation to the time of the mountain, or the time of the bird in relation to the time of the tree. So there's a sense of these sort of various rhythms of movement and duration and change moving through the landscape, and in some very real sense for me, it's kind of moving through my sensorium and through my body as I sat with it. And then partly because of the heat, I guess, but I don't think it's only that, and partly because of the brightness, there's this also the sense of I don't know, anybody seen movies by Peter Weir? Do you know the Australian director? Anybody see Walkabout? I mean, Weir is great at doing that sense of the sort of the outback as this place that's sort of at one and the same time full of this kind of buzzing noise, and you don't know whether it's like the sound of being or the sound of the blood moving in your own ears, you know, or cicadas or something like that, but just this sense of this kind of humming presence of isness, you know, and then that sense at the same time of something very, very still that's part and parcel of the same thing. So I had a very strong sense of that, thinking about that, you know, or being back with that particular landscape. But my sense is that if I'm doing a meditation that's involved in this sort of sinking into sense memory, that's very often a quality of it, you know, the sense of all these kinds of movement, and then the sense of something completely still, you know, that's very important to our practice, and bright at the same time, sort of still and bright and present. You know, we say at the end of the closing ceremony one night, you know, I always carry a light and silence, and there's that sense of sort of silence and stillness as being the heart of the landscape, but not being any different from, in some way, all the motion that's going on, you know. So in that sense, I mean, sitting with your sensorium or your sense memories, I think can be, you know, a very rich kind of thing to do. Another thing I wanted to remind you of from Joan's talks is her sense that when you do that, that your sense of story has pretty much fallen away, at least for a while. You just sort of sink into the landscape, and you know, more so than a relationship, maybe you're not likely to say, well, it's her fault or it's my, you might say it's the volcano's fault, you know. You don't need to tell a lot of stories, you just kind of sit with it. And there's nothing wrong with stories. Stories are great, models are great, and I hope we'll talk about model making and Zen and pragmatism at some other point. But one of the great things that can happen in practice is just having that sort of fall away for a while. And again, you know, you don't have to choose. There can be the stories and the no stories sort of side by side, like a two-panel painting or something like that. And that this is the way they can supplement one another. It's very, very rich and very valuable sometimes. But at any rate, in the talks Joan gave, she reminded us that, I mean, her name for that part of the person where the stories aren't anymore, I guess, is soul rather than self. And she said that in sort of traditional Buddhist terminology, it's also what's called the storehouse consciousness or the alaya vijñana. And there's that sense that there's someplace in you just where all those sense memories sort of fall like layers, and they're in there in some way. And that within the tradition, the storehouse consciousness is understood, you know, either maybe as the place where enlightenment will happen or awakening will happen, or is itself already awakening or enlightenment. So if that's true, the sense that you don't have to do a lot more with that place or that zone if you're there and you're sitting, if you just sit there and let it deepen and ripen to the extent that it wants to, that can be a very important part of practice. So there's that. And then I wanted to sort of jump off from there using just kind of something, you know, kind of a cheap shot in a way, but it turned up, so I want to use it, and I thought about it at the time. So it turns out that in these volcanic fields, and a lot of you probably know a lot more about this than I do, but there are these sort of air pockets underneath them, you know, where there's a lot of sort of empty space under the land, and that it's really cold, and so you get ice caves down there. And we walked down a little bit. We actually, apparently you can sort of see the plugs of ice, which we didn't do, but you feel the sort of icy air sort of coming up from out of the earth. So I thought, oh yeah, well, so in terms of working on the koan no, you know, Hockland says the whole, it was as if the whole universe were sheer darkness. And Lynchy talks about, he said it was like being in an ice cave a million miles thick, you know. So I sort of thought, oh, there's this thing in the landscape that's like the dark mysterious, that's like the well that John talks about that we can't see to the bottom. And that's a sort of 0 degree in some way. You know, I don't think it's really 0 degrees Kelvin, but the ice cave of a million miles thick would be, you know, just that sort of sheer darkness and sheer coldness, you know. So, as I said, that's a description of working on the first koan no, right? Or mu, and, you know, as it's done in, still in Japanese and a lot of American Zen centers. And so that's a very powerful version of a concentration meditation. So I just want to sort of go from there and leap over and talk a little bit about concentration practice, because, you know, Joan talks about it in a few places in the series of talks she gave. And I don't know if this is true, but I kind of have a hunch, and I'd welcome hearing about it, that for a lot of people who sit with us, probably concentration practice is less part of what you do than mindfulness practice. I don't know if that's true or not. How many of you have sort of a concentration practice as a central part of what you do? You know, so yeah, so about half or less than half. So that's maybe kind of interesting. So an all-day sit would be maybe a good time to try out some of that if you want to. So I just wanted to say a couple things about it. You know, so most of you probably know, but I'll just try and say a couple things. So in a way, what, you know, no would be a concentration practice. Doing no, especially in a sort of mantra-like way, where you're just sort of repeating no, maybe on the exhale would be a version of that. Some other mantra practice that you might have would be a version, or breath counting would be a version of that. You know, just focus on 1, 2, 3, up to 10, and then back again. And my sense of how that works is just that, and Joan and other people talk about this a lot, is that in some way you're given something without a lot of tremendously complex content to fill your mind with, you know. And so in some way, the mind starts paying attention to something that's less and less complicated or has less and less content. And so there's a kind of stripping down or paring away that goes along with that. Part of what happens through that for a lot of people is that the mind becomes, or consciousness becomes, very conscious of itself. So it's sort of consciousness looking at consciousness. And that can be sort of maddening, you know, or it can get fairly quiet, and some interesting things can happen with that. Another thing that tends to happen, I think, is that in some sense, as the content grows thinner and thinner, one of the things that will tend to happen is the tension in some way tends to go inward, and not just toward your thoughts, but it sort of enters the dark space of the body or something like that is what might happen. But at any rate, I think a lot of times people's eyes will kind of roll back into their head, so you're not looking at very much. But at any rate, in addition to that sense of just sort of consciousness looking at consciousness, a very common and powerful part of concentration practice can be that sense, in a way, that stuff just falls away, that in some way there's not very much there, or that there's nothing there, or that the whole universe is sheer darkness, you know. And that moment of stuff dropping away is one of the benefits, I guess, and one of the very powerful features for most people at some point of concentration practice. I would associate that, you know, with that well that John talks about, looking into where the dark mysterious, and then the sutra that that a lot of us know, either as the Sandokai, you know, if you're sitting with Norman, or as taking part in the gathering by Shitto, if you're sitting with us. That sense of, well, one of the early phrases is, the mysterious source of the bright is clear and unstained. Branches of light stream from that dark. And so John associates that with, and I think it's true, you know, sort of historically for Shitto and so on, but with not only a Chan sense, but with a Taoist sense, sort of underneath that, of a really sort of profound nothingness from which things flower or emerge. And so in some way, to sit with that nothing is to sit with something very powerful that in some way is an origin of everything that is, you know. I think people have really different reactions to that dark place, you know. One can be that it's very, very calming, very tranquil, very peaceful, and you could happily spend a lot of time there and sort of a drag to have to come back from there. Another can be that it makes you really uneasy or nervous or profoundly terrified. I mean, those are all possible reactions. And I think, as with a lot of other things with our practice, and we've been talking about this a little bit in the last couple of weeks, you are, you know, guidance is really useful, but you're really the guide, you're one of the crucial guides for your own practice. And so you make your decisions, you know, too scary, not going to go there now, pretty scary, going to go there, all of a sudden not so scary. But certainly be ready for it to change on a dime, and for what's scary to all of a sudden get not scary, you know. So I would recommend that. Another thing that will happen, and Jonah's talked about this a lot, is the sense that that's not the end point. So if you think that, you know, oops, so now there's nothing and that's the end of Zen practice, if you just sit there for sometimes a few minutes, sometimes years, you know, but something will shift and there's something else in that moment and in that place. And so I guess the other thing I would want to stress is that in some important way, the way in which that sense of the dark, mysterious, you know, nothing there at all, and that sense, on the other hand, of that really sort of bright light that's completely still and radiant and timeless, and then that sense of these various rhythms of things moving in their activity, sort of growing out of that, that somehow the relations among those three things and sort of, you know, finding your way among them or letting them find their way through you is a really important aspect of practice, and the way in which one will turn into the other and can have a very beautiful relation to the other is also really, really important, I think. I wanted to say I should stop. I was going to say a couple practical things, but I'll forget about that, you know, in terms of what you might do if it's going badly or something seems to be going not how you'd like, but clearly we're just about out of time, so I'm going to stop there and we can pick up a little bit more, you know, some other time, maybe during the sit. But so anything about that,
I just want to say, when you started to allude to what you could do, that that this is a great thing to bring to practice discussion. These are the kind of things that you could talk with Penny about, you know, that when you're in practice and things are happening, that's been my experience anyway. Yeah. It's a good thing to it's a good place to go with it.
Yeah, thanks. That's certainly a lot of my experience. This thing is happening, what can I do with it? Or how, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just that.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. This is really timely for me because I'm finding that that in this precepts process that I'm in before taking refuge in just a few weeks, that it's revealing to me all sorts of things. And a lot of what's being revealed is some, I guess, hidden expectations. And so what you said about, you know, something that's scary suddenly becomes not, like, that's what I'm finding. Like, this is the biggest adventure of my lifetime. Just turning inward and watching and seeing what happens. Yeah. And I guess the other thing I would say is that there have been, this process is really intense. And what I've come to understand in just starting to touch on the precepts is that, because it feels like this tango. Two teeny steps forward, big jump back. Two teeny steps forward, big jump back. Like, and a lot of it's been very scary for me, to be honest. And what I'm finding is that the concentration practice that you talked about, through my own sitting practice and knowledge of what that's like for me, is actually bringing calm to the process. Like, if I go into that weak back spot where I just feel like this is too much and I'm freaking out, if I use that concentration practice, it takes my mind into that place where that you described, that it's I'm consciousness watching consciousness, but it's not focusing on that fear place anymore, and so I can kind of regain some stability and ground through that. And sometimes it's breath counting and sometimes it's using no, but both are equally effective.
Yeah.
And it was really nice to hear you talk about
it. That's great. Thanks. I find a little bit over the years that, so I mean, everything's practice, you know, but if there was such a thing as practice and non-practice, you know, that
to some extent, gradually, what I learned like that in practice sort of helps me in non-practice, and I can sort of bring that to other paths in some way. And then when you talk about the forward and back, Joan used to talk a lot about sort of, you keep getting, you know, just the knockdown and get back up again. But a lot of, you know, sort of sitting retreats for years is an experience like that. It's like, oh, well, this retreat really knocked me down, you know, time to get back up again and come back and try another.
And what are my ideas about that? What I'm realizing is I'm holding ideas that were completely unconscious before that I should be able to, you know, whatever, fill in the blank. Yeah. And it's like, well, get rid of that, you know, like, and realizing that my precepts process is my process and it's not going to look like anybody else's and it's going to be messy and it's going to be a lifelong adventure that is just now beginning.
Yeah. That's good. Thanks. Anything else, or just about out of time?
I'm good. I would say something that in my own work with Mu, it's interesting to hear you talk about concentration as the description of process of sort of how of what that feels like, because what I brought to it, or what it helped reveal to me, was direct awareness. That actually that observer was completely pulled out, and it felt like the sense of what was happening and not me being the person sensing it and not any of the stories that I would take to it. And it was a major change in my practice and fundamentally changed me and as a person. And so, and I guess that's concentration. But the only other thing I would say is that in thinking about sort of what you were talking about in terms of darkness, and I think I'm actually most comfortable in that place where all meaning is pulled away. That when I start attaching meaning to things around me, that's when I start getting squirrely as a person.
Yeah.
It's when things get pulled away that I can breathe.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Of course, the meanings are always going to come back, right?
They always do. And then I get anxious, and I get all of the physical stuff that happens to me happens.
I'm glad you said what you said, because I guess what I was doing is... So one of the things that Mu or no practice can be about is a concentration practice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's sort of in the present context, the way Joan has brought it up again.
Mm-hmm.
But you can do a bazillion different things with no practice. So I remember, like, the first time I met her, that I had sat Rinzai a long time ago, and my understanding was that Mu was exactly a concentration practice. And she said, well, you can do it that way, but really fundamentally it's a permeability practice. And I was just outraged and offended. You know, it turned out to be really great. And then she had this thing where, you know, you could pick which horse to ride. Do you know what I mean? So you could do it as a concentration practice.
Mm-hmm.
You could do it as a permeability. And one of the things, let me say just one more thing. So one of the things that happens with concentration practice sometimes is that it can be really calm, but you can also get the sense of really intense energy with it. You know, everything is just really sort of, mm-hmm. you know, charging along. And a lot of times that can feel great, but sometimes it can feel, it's starting to make you tense or something like that. So that would be a time maybe to say, oh, I'm going to relax and just sort of notice what's around me and to do it as a permeability practice. And the cool thing about that is, like, you've gone someplace really different. So there's this funny thing, and anybody remember Pogo, the Walt Kelly comic strip? But it has a sort of mannerist moment in one of the books where the characters are walking around and they say, gosh, look at the artwork. You know, where they're sort of walking around in a frame. But you can have that reaction to it. You know, it's like through concentration practice, you're really in a different place, and you can sort of get off the boat or get out of the airplane or the whatever it is and look around you. And it's a really, it for me, it feels like it's not exactly an exterior landscape, you know, but it's not exactly interior. It's sort of the space of whatever my body and consciousness feel like, and then sort of what that's like as an environment that I'm inside. So I think you had to sort of, to pick moments of sort of sliding back and forth between sort of concentration and mindfulness or permeability is really, really a productive thing to do also. So if I said anything and you say, oh, that's not my experience, it doesn't mean that you know, it just means I left something out. That's all it means.
Is permeability interchanged with mindfulness? Is that
I'm sort of using it that way, and a little bit of that happened at our winter retreat because Joan was talking about mindfulness, and I had such a strong association to her, having talked a lot about permeability about a decade before, that I sort of brought that back into the conversation, and I didn't get rebuked. So I mean, I think for Joan, they're probably not identical, but they're in the same neighborhood in some way. So she talks a lot about sort of mindfulness, you know, bringing back the field of others and that sense of everything being interpermeated. So in that sense, it would be very close to permeability, I think. Is there anything else before we close?
I just had a very strong resonance with the very first part of what you were talking about, the being infused with the landscape. And that timeless quality that happens. It's a different part of my life, but hearing you talk about it here, it's like, oh, it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
I think it can be a part of this practice.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
So,
great.
I had one tiny note along with the landscape when Jill said two steps forward, one step back. And you had mentioned Sunset Crater, and I went there as a child, and all of the Southwest, all the camping, all the monuments, and that was two steps forward, one step back, going up that crater, and that so vividly, and so it all got tied together.
Yeah, the kids charged. I didn't try to climb it, but the kids charged.
Yeah.
I don't know what I want to say about this, but something about, you both alluded to meaning somehow. I don't want to say it was demonized, but it feels like it's really important that understand that meaning is important. It's just we change the meaning somehow, you know, that it's that part of that mindfulness practice of observing what it means to us and what we might attach to it as meaning. I don't even know what I'm trying to say, but...
It
feels like meaning still is, it's all part of it. You know, it's not something to be disposed of.
I mean, you couldn't get along very long without imputing meanings to stuff, I think, you know. And the sort of self function or the constructed self function.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a mess, but it's a great pleasure aside from being, you know, really necessary to survival, probably. So again, sort of one thing next. But my sense is if you go to that place where meaning isn't so important, that you come back to the land of meaning with a sort of different relation to it and a different... In a way, it's like you don't believe your own press quite as much. Do you know what I mean? I mean, here's what it means. Well, maybe not. You know, but,
that happened to me in the sutra service today. So I'm getting what you're saying. I remember the first time I was here, it was for a sutra service, and I remember hearing some of those things going, what? In my mind, like, what, really?
Yeah.
And today I saw that the meaning that I carried in with me that first time I was here didn't have such a grip on me, and it just there was so much more life to it and such a more expansive view of how it all fit together. I was like, just in the short, I don't know how I've been coming a couple of months now, just in that short space of time, meaning has changed.
It's almost as if meaning's a tool.
Doesn't have to work on, you know?
I think, I mean, it must be part of Zen tradition in a really important way, but I know it's something that Joan really stresses, you know, and the Tuesday night thing, we're starting to do the Vimalakirti Sutra again, and it's all over that one. But sort of any time you want to say, oh, now that I've discovered it's X, now I know it's not Y anymore, you know, it's not X anymore, that's almost, you know, pretty much never what our practice is about, and it's just, oh, it's this, and it's this, you know. And if you know it's this also, then your relation to it's this is changed. It doesn't exactly. It doesn't have quite the sort of you know death grip on you anymore.
Yeah, I was gonna say only it like this rather than this.
Yeah. That's good. And when I'm doing that, I'm sort of aware that I'm doing this. Oh, I'm doing that. You know, maybe I could do that. No, I can't. Yeah.
It's okay. No.
Yeah.
When we
did the meditation, I was very much into the sutra service, like almost in a trance from it. And I found that I started to meditate Kanzi Gong. I was like still in that rhythm, and I was just that for a while. I just, you know, went there and I just stayed with that. It was like in that rhythm of that. It was just so in my body.
Yeah, that's the same thing I was talking about. Just then. Yeah. Thank you.